Welcome to the second half of the first seminar on writing the history of the First World War. And we got as far as these politicians and generals' memoirs. These are important to generals and politicians. I think it's important with today's perhaps understandably cynical way of looking at politicians not to forget that politicians are very keen that history should recognise that they did a good job, or perhaps at least that they did as well as could be expected. So it's not surprising to see the publication of these memoirs. And here you have another example in French, Marcel Foch, who of course was very was very fiercely criticised, and so it's not surprising to see that he has wanted to publish his own version of the story of the war. Other people also wrote memoirs. Ordinary soldiers often don't write memoirs because they have to work, you know. Once the war is over. But there is another group of people who are not powerful who often want to write memoirs, and these are, anybody got an idea what category of people write memoirs? Yeah. Activists. Yeah. Activists write memoirs because they consider that there are that they were involved in campaigns which made some good decisions and some bad decisions, and perhaps the next generation of activists will learn something from their past. And just like politicians and generals, activists are very serious about what they do. And this is by a fabulous book by Sylvia Pankhurst, who is the daughter of... Which one is she the daughter of? Emmeline Pankhurst. Emmeline Pankhurst is the tremendously well-known leader of the women's suffrage movement in Britain, the suffragettes. She has a statue. There is a statue of Emmeline Pankhurst in front of the Houses of Parliament. I think she's the only woman with a statue in front of that House of Parliament. And Emmeline Pankhurst, so Sylvia's mother, was involved in the suffragette movement for a long time. And on the arrival of the war, the majority of suffragette leaders agreed to stop campaigning and to work to support the war. And in particular, Emmeline Pankhurst was a very enthusiastic supporter of the war. However, she had four daughters, and two of them were in favour of the war, and two of them were against the war. And Sylvia Pankhurst was against the war, and indeed in 1920, I think she will join the Communist Party after the war. During the war, Sylvia Pankhurst worked in the poor parts of London, organising the women. Many of the women were left with the children because their husbands had gone off to war, very often they had difficulty getting support from the government. For example, if your husband had gone to the army, you were allowed to get a little bit of money from the government. And you could get a little bit of money from your children, but not if you weren't married when they were born. Illegitimate children, you couldn't get any money for them. So it's 100 years ago, yeah? And Sylvia Pankhurst was involved in organising these women. She also established a series of toy workshops to give work to poorer women, to making toys. She worked with tremendous energy throughout the war, and she wrote her memoir called The Home Front. It's not a very good title, actually, because it sounds very neutral, but it's not. William Gallagher, who wrote his memoir, Revolt on the Clyde. The Clyde is the river which goes through the town of Glasgow. And Glasgow is very specific in that Glasgow was the most left-wing town in Britain. On mainland Britain, Glasgow was the only place you had a big anti-war movement. Yeah. There was a big anti-war movement in Northern Ireland, in Ireland indeed, but Ireland is a little bit special. On mainland Britain, Glasgow was the most anti-war place. This worried the government tremendously because Glasgow built half of the ships that the Navy needed. So we wrote Arthur McLeod, and that particular source was then, Activists' Memoirs. Somebody already mentioned contemporary newspapers as an obvious source. Not always a source which is very easy to exploit, because there's so many of them. Yeah. A daily newspaper, the full newspaper, every day, where do you start? You have to make sure you have a good specific question to go into it. So there you have the Times, for example. There's nothing particular going on there. The Times. Notice how they were written at the time, the newspapers. No, very few photographs. In fact, I think that the daily newspapers didn't have photographs because they were too expensive. The Herald is the only anti-war newspaper which continued to appear throughout the war. And this is quite an interesting part of the history, because in several countries it was impossible to produce an anti-war newspaper because the government censored it. This was not the case in Britain. The British government allowed the anti-war newspaper to continue being published. Now, this was probably partly because the newspaper did not have very much influence, but nevertheless, it was something very go on there. And there you can see the headline of the Herald, the anti-war newspaper: "You workers must end war, or war will end you." Which sounds rather melodramatic, but then again, when there were thousands being killed every week, it might have sounded less melodramatic. The Sunday Herald, which is not connected to the Daily Herald, is a weekly illustrated newspaper. And so, for example, some historians have written books about the cartoons in the newspapers during the war. And then again, you choose a particular source, but then you have to be able to work on the grammar of cartoons. That is, what do the different kinds of caricature, the history of cartoons, where they're coming from, who is reading them. So you once you've got your source, you need to understand its grammar. For example, when I worked on the popular song, I had to understand that what was important to people was singing along. 100 years ago, during the First World War, popular song was not for dancing, like it was for my parents. It was not for listening to on your MP3 player, like it is for me. It was for singing along, for everybody singing together. Now, they had to all sing together for another reason, because the big theatres have 2,000 or 3,000 seats, but the singer does not have a microphone. No microphones on stage until 1928. And so it's quite difficult to do. You imagine a theatre with 3,000 people and you're singing. Okay, you have an orchestra, you have to make a lot of noise, but it's even better if the chorus has everybody singing together. That helps you along. And it's very much a comic show. Yeah, so when you have the sing-along, you say, okay, well, that wasn't very good. Let's have just the ladies singing along. Now let's have just the gentlemen. You know, it was the idea of what a pop singer was not like today, when we like the pop singers to be full of authenticity and genuine feeling. And this was not a problem at the time. They were showmen. It was a little bit like the circus. You know, when you go to the circus and they say, and now we have the acrobats from North Korea. And you know that they're from Sotheville. But because, you know, they just have to be from somewhere exotic. That's part of the show. Okay, contemporary newspapers. They show some things about the propaganda campaign at the time. There, for example, the German gun in Liverpool. Once they captured guns on the battlefield, sometimes they took them round the country to show everybody. It's to encourage you, want everybody to work hard for the war. But remember, they're not seeing the war on the television. They're not hearing about the war on the radio. They might read a newspaper, but they might not. And so the physical elements, like the German gun, which is coming, oh, look, well, our boys captured this gun, are very important. Photographs. Obvious primary source, photographs of army life. The difficulties of the source is that most people did not have a camera. And secondly, we always say the camera never lies, but in fact, of course, you can pose the camera. One of the wonderful things about photographs is that sometimes you get information from the photographs which was not the reason for the photograph. For example, obviously, this is the reason for the photograph, that these people are happy that their regiment has been honoured. But sometimes in the background, you get information, free information, extra information. Photographs of army life, or indeed, photographs of civilian life. There you have a woman working in the arms factories. What's that? It's a team of people who do what? How many are there? Yeah, it's a football. It's a football team. It's a football team. There are 11 of them. What else can you do in groups of 11? Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Okay, it's a football team. And what is particular about this football team? They're women. Women's football was bigger in 1917 than in 2017. It was much more of it. It's tremendously popular. Which is not what you would expect. You know, we always imagine that, you know, that what happened in the 20th century to women is that they weren't allowed to do anything, and then they were allowed to do a bit more. It's absolute nonsense. It's much more complicated than that. And indeed, women's football was bigger. There was a reason for this, because people loved football even more than today. Football, as you know, is a national religion in England. But they couldn't have men's football because it was politically impossible. In 1914 and 1915, many young men volunteered for the army. And if they didn't, they were under pressure to do so. So it was impossible to organise young men playing football in public, because the public would have said, why aren't you in the army? Nevertheless, they liked football, and so they organised more and more women's football. And by 1918, they'll have like tens of thousands of people watching women's football. Also, the women, the young women in particular, were often working in the munitions factories, and they were living in specialised accommodation. There was a big factory, and next door they had like an army camp full of women who'd come there because the wages were good. And these are the younger women who don't yet have children, so it's easier. And they were very bored, and so they organised football teams for each section of the factory, and there was a whole league of things going on. And so that's a fascinating side to it, because we often have a rather strange vision of women 100 years ago. One of the things which we often forget, I think, is the difference between one town and another. For example, we sometimes see in history books, what was the percentage of married women going out to work, which is an important statistic, yeah? And as you know, it got bigger and bigger. However, in 1914, the percentage of women going out to work was 11% in some towns and 40% in other towns. So we always have to be careful not to imagine that everything was the same. The reason for this is that in towns where there were factories, there was often 40% of women, married women, going out because the wages were good and because they wanted to. In other towns where there were no factories, what did the working women do? They were domestic servants. In 1914 in Britain, there are still millions of domestic servants. And women didn't like being domestic servants, because it's horrible being a domestic servant. People preferred to work in factories. And so, in fact, the percentage of women working goes up when there's in the towns where there's a factory. A lot of work still to be done on that. So, photographs of civilian life, and there are women tram workers. Now, there is a problem with photographs of civilian life, and this is the problem of selection. If you imagine an alien came from Mars and took all your photographs that you have taken this last year. This is less the case today with the mobile phones, but if you imagine they stole all your parents' photograph albums, they would conclude that most of the population spend most of their time on holiday. because of course you take photographs on holiday when you don't take photographs of your classes. How many photographs of your classes have? Like I say, it's a little different now with your mobile phones. So one of the problems of collections of photographs is that things have been photographed for a reason, and quite often you photograph what is exceptional and not what is typical. This is unfortunate because historians are most interested in what is typical. But discovering what is typical is really quite hard work sometimes. Photographs of civilian life in Britain. We're still on sources. Posters. There you have one. It is far better to face the bullets than to be killed at home by a bomb. Join the army at once and help to stop an air raid. What is that? What can you see in the picture? What is that? It's a Martian who's come to... No, it's not a Martian. Do you know what it is? Vous savez ce que c'est en français? C'est un pas? Oui, tout à fait, c'est un dirigeable. That is to say, or what we call in English, an airship. An airship. Because although, as I'm sure you know, especially in Normandy, the Second World War was mostly characterised by bombing towns, as Normandy knows very well, the First World War did have some bombing of towns, not a lot, but some. And in particular, the Germans managed to send Zeppelins to bomb some of the coastal towns in Britain. This made people very angry because it was the first time in history that towns had been that civilian towns had been bombed. And so they weren't expecting it. They expected war to be different. And therefore, you got this kind of poster. Remember, the government is still trying to get the maximum number of people to join the army, and they're getting everybody involved. The church leaders are saying, yes, join the army. The trade union leaders are saying, yes, join the army. The feminist leaders, they're saying, yes, join the army. The writers, Rudyard Kipling and H.G. Wells and all the famous writers. Who's the guy who wrote Peter Pan? Can't remember his name now. No. Thank you. Who?
James Barry.
Yeah, James Barry. Yeah, they were all writing. Why you should join the army? Yeah, the entire civil society, with a tiny number of exceptions, were in favour of this war. That's one of the most depressing things, actually. And so the government was trying with these things to, you know, of course you're frightened to go and face the bullets, aren't you? Yes, me too. But it's far better to face the bullets than to be killed at home by a bomb, isn't it? Yes, so. And that's a rather unusual one, because that sounds like you're appealing to people to the self-interest of the men. You're frightened of the bullets, you should be frightened of the bomb. That's rather unusual. Usually it says, you know, it is your duty to protect your women. That's a much more common expression. Here you get another one. Remember Scarborough. Scarborough is a coastal town. Still today a good place to go on holiday if you don't like sun. Remember Scarborough. Remember the bombing of Scarborough. The Germans who brag of their culture have shown what it is made of by murdering defenceless women and children at Scarborough. But this only strengthens Great Britain's resolve to crush the German barbarians. Join the army now. Endless, join the army. So one of the good things of having a volunteer army, when I say good, I mean for the historian. We don't mind about the people who have been killed. The historians are pleased there was a volunteer army, because it meant you had this massive propaganda campaign which you can analyse, and also it made it a little bit easier to analyse what people thought of the war. If you have a conscription and all men are automatically a member of the army, it's difficult to know what they thought. Whereas if you have a volunteering campaign, you can get more information. And the famous... very famous poster, which was reprised in the Second World War and indeed in the First World War by Uncle Sam. But this is the original. In fact, originally it wasn't a poster. It was the front page of a magazine. How do you read it? Can anybody read it? Can you read it? Don't look behind you, Francois. Can you read that, the poster? Yeah, and it's not, but it can't really be that, can it? Because Britons wants you. It's impossible. That's plural. That's singular. Yeah. So what do you need to know to read this? You need to know, who is this man? And the reason they don't have his name is because it's not necessary. Everybody knows who he is, but not you. But they did. Okay, Lord Kitchener. A hero of the imperialist wars of the 19th century, of the colonial wars. The man who fought in Egypt and conquered this and that, yeah? A national hero. Lord Kitchener wants you. And he's so famous you don't even need his name, and that's why he's looking at you, pointing at you. And he's thinking, oh, it's like, you know, Superman wants you, you know? God save the king. So, very skilled propaganda poster for the... So, posters is your source. One more. National Service Women Clerks wanted at once for service in France with the British Army. As the war went on, there were not enough soldiers because they kept dying. And so they tried to replace soldiers with women in particular jobs, not just in Britain, but also just behind the lines in France. So here you have women clerks wanted. So les employés de bureau. Also telephone operators and so on. So you found a more and more, as the war went on, women involved in support roles inside the military, driving trucks and so on, which could sometimes allow women to do things that they weren't allowed to do before. And there's been a big debate gone on about the positive side of the war. It sounds like a strange thing to say about a war that killed millions of people, but certainly, firstly, women were allowed to do far more things in the war, look at the football, than they were previously. And secondly, strangely enough, if you were very poor and you didn't get killed in the war, you probably had a better life than before the war. There was no unemployment. And remember, at this time, when you're unemployed, your children are hungry. And it's very hard being unemployed today. But if you're unemployed today, typically your children are not hungry. And so, you know, so the war was a terrible thing, but also the wages were good. The wages went up. The government needed the workers. The trade unions became more powerful. If you weren't killed and you were poor, you might have had a better job, a better life during the war than before. These are things that we're still studying, because when we look at the First World War today, we think, oh my God, look at these soldiers in the trenches. I could never stand that horrible life, which is true. However, if you were all transformed into working class men and women in Manchester in 1910, you couldn't stand that life either, watching your children die. It was already a horrible situation before the war, and that may have been one of the reasons that they survived. These are difficult things to analyse. How did people survive psychologically 100 years ago? That's difficult stuff, yeah, because especially because people didn't write about their feelings. Sources, posters. That was posters. I still have a few more sources for you, although I'm going to try to... Oh, and this one is American, but I just liked it too much. This was my favourite one. Give to the American Chocolate Fund for US forces in France. I think it's just the greatest poster. Look at the happy American soldier who's just eaten a lot of chocolate. What's not to like? Okay, there's a war on, but you get chocolate. That's pretty good, I think. More sources. Cartoons. In fact, they are postcards. Those are picture postcards. Postcards are particularly interesting because they are very reactive to the market. Notice the difference between postcards and posters. The posters are written by the Government Propaganda Committee, yeah, the official. Postcards are made by small private companies who are writing what they think people want to buy. They're very close to the market. They're very close to the people who are buying them. And that means that you can make particular conclusions about what's in them. That's a postcard which mocks the German Navy because they are all very old. The German Navy are accused of being all old men. Yes, it's "We savoir beau," d'accord. Here you have the Kaiser hiding under the attacks of all these different countries. The Kaiser, then the Emperor, leader of Germany. Of course, the most bizarre thing at the beginning of the war is that the Kaiser, the leader of Germany, the Tsar, the leader of Russia, and the King of England, they were all related. They were all second cousins of this or that, which is it's rather unusual. That's a Northern Irish, an Ulster poster. How is freedom measured? By the effort which it costs to retain freedom. Okay? And she's happy to go off to war under the British flag. Again, here you have a postcard with a woman raising a rifle. As you can imagine, there are not so many. Normally you imagine that there would be a man raising a rifle, so that there are things to analyse there. The kitchen is the key to victory, eat less bread. Okay, postcards. A lot of the postcards were rather kitsch. And so here you have a sort of a lovey-dovey story. My favourite. What are these? What is that, in fact? I might be able to find it for you, you never know. There's another one. What do you think they are? That's a little bit of a clue, isn't it? What are they? Well, they're songs. They are songs. I'm trying to find them here. Sorry, I was trying to find it so that you could hear it, but I'm not doing very well with this. Yeah, there you go.
Now I was winged on cucumber and on my wedding day, when the sun was low.
Etc. I have 350 at home. What can I say about them as sources? This is the source which I know best. Sheet music is the main source. Records are not very important. Gramophones are not very important. They exist. The first gramophone recordings are in the 1880s. In 1904, Caruso, the very great opera singer, recorded records of his songs, and that made them more popular. And little by little, the middle class, the bourgeois, were being persuaded to have a gramophone at home. These were enormous machines, like this, very, very beautiful in mahogany. At the very beginning, it was like geeks who had a record player at home. And then little by little, they became respectable. At the beginning, people didn't want them. I don't want a record of a violin. My brother can play the violin. I don't need a record, yeah? But little by little, when they realized that they could hear Caruso singing, of course, the quality is not great at the time. So let's say that the gramophones were rising little by little, but most people didn't have a gramophone. Many of the soldiers listened to a gramophone for the first time during the war. Or you could listen to one before the war if you went on holiday. You went on holiday to Blackpool, and there's a specialized shop, and you put headphones on and you can hear a gramophone. It's amazing. But for most people, there were two forms of buying music. One was the theatre show, the musical theatre show, the musical, and the second was sheet music. There were over 3 million pianos in Britain in 1914. That's one for every 15 members of the public, men, women and babies. These were not restricted to the middle class. Many working class families had a piano, also, of course, all the pubs had a piano. The piano was what made the popular songs live. That you heard them once at the theatre, then you bought the sheet music and you played them at home 100 times. Then you have an anti-war song. There were not many anti-war songs in the music hall. This one was produced in America before America joined the war. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I will put a couple of these on the blog. And one which has remained famous, It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Historians for a long time always quoted the same songs, the same 5 songs. There are 5 songs which are still famous today. What happened to me is that I assumed that somebody had written a book about popular song in the First World War. And it was when I discovered that nobody had written a book on it that I decided that I would write that book. Historians are always very pleased to see that nobody has done something, because that means you can have it. Sheet music. Now, these are not going to work, I don't think. No, they're not going to work. That was supposed to be to play music. Oh, that's my book. My book. Famous. Famous at last. Just to say something about the photograph here. Firstly, also, I'm very old, so I had a lot of time, but it takes 5 years to write a book on a new subject like that. But what I liked about this was the photograph, because these are 3 very famous pop stars from the time. And as you can see, the most important thing is to be comic. Yeah, they're obviously dressed in a comic way. And it's a sort of circus atmosphere to it. Although, in fact, they were being photographed there just before they sang one of the very first romantic duets in the history of British popular music. You didn't get romantic duets. And they sang If You Were the Only Girl in the World, which is still famous today. And they were going to sing it as a comic song. And at the very last moment, they changed their mind and sang it straight. And it became a smash hit. You can hear it in Downton Abbey. Sources. Literary works written during the war. Most famously is the last one there, War Poems. Now, for a reason which I'm not really quite sure why, the war poets, Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, and people like that, are the most popular poets in Britain, even today. Today, if you do an opinion poll, who are your favourite poets? The First World War poets are right up there. These are generally anti-war poems, the famous ones. So that's something rather specific. There are also novels. This is a novel by H.G. Wells. Mr. Britling sees it through. It's not one of his famous novels, but it is one of his best novels. Now, H.G. Wells was not against the war. He wanted Britain to win the war, but he wasn't enthusiastic about the war either. But what's interesting in the novel is, in many ways, the novel is better than H.G. Wells himself, because in there are people debating about the war, some people who want to go to war and some people who don't know what they want and are not sure, and then there's they have a German friends, and it's actually a very complex approach to the war, which is quite refreshing. A very good novel. Of course, he's much more famous for his novels like Kipps and War of the Worlds and what else did he write? The Invisible Man. Anything else? Any H.G. Wells fans in the room? Yep, good lad, H.G. Wells. George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw was the political playwright just before the war. He has a link to Rouen because he wrote an important play, Saint Joan, about Joan of Arc. But this is a time, again, the cinema is silent cinema. There is no radio, there is no television. Theatre was very political, or could be very political. George Bernard Shaw was one of the bravest political playwrights at the time. He wrote a play about suffragettes. He wrote a play about prostitution. He wrote plays about the First World War, and so on. He wrote a play about Joan of Arc. So one of the most celebrated playwrights of the time. And you can use the literary works during the war to analyse and try to think out what it shows about the history of mentalities, an interesting idea. There is a people write about the history of mentalities. It's not so fashionable now. 20 years ago, a lot of historians wanted to write the history of mentalities. And then some people said, do mentalities really exist? And there was a big debate about it. It was not an easy idea, but that was one thing. It has to be said that there are many, many, many books about literature during the war. And in fact, what is really fashionable today for the First World War is books about women's writings during the war. In fact, there are more books about women's writings during the war than about women during the war, which is, I'm not quite sure why. I suspect it's that there are more literary people wanting to study women's writings than there are historians wanting to study what happened to women. But the First World War is rather bizarre as well, because of course, initially the First World War attracts people who like war. Not all First World War historians like war. I don't think it's very nice myself. But obviously it's an initial attraction, and so it is first of all, it, for a long time, it attracted very few women. That's not the case today. Today you have leading military historians like Lynn Thomas. Who are women? You're leading military historians of the First World War, but that's recent. And even today, you only get a few of them. You only get a few of them. So we'll see more of this. Literary works written during the war, and those are books about literary works. There you see on the right, women's writings on the First World War. There are loads of them. And then on the left, touch and intimacy in First World War literature. So you're looking at all the books that were written during the war, and how did they deal with questions of intimacy and touch? And what does this show us about attitudes of the time? Did attitudes change during the war? Because bodies are very important in war. Thousands of nurses discovered more about the bodies than about men's bodies than they wanted to discover, because these bits of them were torn off and so on, you know. And the whole society had much more experience of wounds and disfigurement and so on. So poems of the time. Some of the poems became extremely popular. This is one from the beginning of the war by Rupert Brooke. This is not the whole poem, it's just a part of it. One of the most famous ones. Has anybody seen this before? Well, if you were English, you would say, yeah, we saw this in the first year at school, and the second year at school, and the third year at school. Fair enough. Anyway, here you go. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers and blessed by suns of home. So probably one of the best patriotic poems of the time, where he's imagining that even if he dies, he will leave English dust in foreign lands. Why not? This poem, If I Should Die, was first published in London in November 1917 and reprinted in February 1918. So it was very popular already before the war. After the war, it was more likely to be anti-war poems which would become popular. And this one is by Wilfred Owen again. Has anybody seen this poem before? Okay, this may be the most famous poem in the English language, in Britain. And it's about being a soldier and how glorious it is not. Gas, quick boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. One of the soldiers was not quick enough with the gas mask. And then later, that what happens to the soldier? If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes rising in his face, his hanging face like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable songs on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, Duce et decorum est, pro patria mori. Yes. It is sweet and fitting to die for your country. In the Latin slogan. So this anti-war song became tremendously popular. This is the poem where if you ask your sister-in-law who works at a shop in England, do you know any poems? She may know one. This might be it. Yeah, it is tremendously well known. Still have a few sources left to go. Literature written later. Now, this is no longer a primary source if it's literature written later. But people write about it. Now, when they write about literature written later, studying the different ways that the First World War, for example, has been presented in novels. There's one from 1929, Im Westen nicht Neues, A l'Ouest rien de nouveau, en français. Then you can get into a whole debate of whether they're writing history or not. That is to say that some people might write the history of the way that the First World War is portrayed in British novels between 1935 and 1955. And they might discover that the picture of the First World War in the 1930s is very different from the picture in the 1950s. This is what we sometimes call the history of representation. And it's very, very popular today. Among historians. Yeah, it's very, 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 very popular. So that can be a source. Has anybody seen this before? It's in Paris. Paintings at the time. These are paintings at the time. This one in 1916 by Mark Gertler. It's called The Merry-Go-Rounds. And because of the time, we understand that the merry-go-round is the war. And nobody can stop it. And everybody is lined up like in the army. And they all have wooden expressions. And there's a tremendous amount of restrained pain there. So it was, in some ways, an anti-war painting during the war. But at the same time, the army had its official painters. So this bottom one here is Louis Viateur, who was a painter employed by the army to make pictures. So this is always an interesting side of it, where you have official war artists. Because as well as winning the war, the elites wish to control and irrigate the way that the war is presented. There's a very quite complicated thing. Why do governments pay money to have official war artists? It's about legitimacy. It's about, we're not just people who win wars, we're people who understand the aesthetic way of looking at the changes and conflicts. But there are many, I'm hoping to open a lot of questions, but a lot of them I don't have the answer to, which is okay. Sources, which nobody mentioned when I looked for sources, cinema. Cinema is very important after 1904 is the year that the first cinema is built in Britain. The first building which was built specially to be a cinema. Not the first films. We have films of Queen Victoria, who died in 1901. Of course, these are silent films, and because we're very modern, we don't really like silent films very much. How many people like silent films? it's difficult for us. We're not used to it. Although there was what was that film a few years ago, just 5 years ago, which was brought out to today's film. That's right, The Artist, which was, did you see it? Yeah. Did you like it? Not that much. Yes, that's true. But I was surprised that I didn't think it was possible to make a silent film popular today. But obviously it was. Silent films. I guess you probably know a little bit of Charlie Chaplin. But most silent films we've never seen. But from the historian's point of view, silent films can be very interesting. And the Battle of the Somme was a film which came from the battlefield. Not during the battle, but in between battles. And it was a smash hit in Britain, every cinema. Because you have to try to imagine what people were like in 1914. They knew a lot more than you do about death. They watched their children die, they watched their parents die. People died at home. But they knew much less than you about war. They'd never seen photographs of war. They'd never seen films of war. Whereas, of course, you can see them every day on the television today. So they're very different people at the time. And so they were fascinated to see the Battle of the Somme. And this was very surprising in a way, because the Battle of the Somme actually showed dead British soldiers. And it was an absolute shock to people, because they had a strange vision of what war should be like. And indeed, the Battle of the Somme was a warning to the government. And after the Battle of the Somme, they established a government committee to control the cinema. Because they realised later. So the government often learn things as they go along. Things happen in surprising ways. The other thing about cinema is that we say it's silent cinema. Of course, it was not silent cinema, because there was always music. Where does the music come from? Yeah, the pianist. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a pianist in the cinema. It's a job. A lot of people had a job as being a pianist in the cinema. However, they don't invent the music as they go along. When they receive the film, they receive a list of music that they should play. And this was lost. And recently, a historian has found many, many lists of the music they should play and has reproduced the silent film with the music which was recommended at the time. And it's absolutely fascinating, because it's really very, very jolly and comic music when they're attacking. So there's a lot of things you can discover. That's about, again, thinking about the grammar of silent cinema. And the first thing to think about is to put the cinema back in its position at the time, that is, playing to people who've never seen a war film, which we can't imagine, we've seen so many, and secondly, that it's playing with music at the same time. That is a scene from the Battle of the Somme. And there is the book by the people I mentioned, British Silent Cinema and the Great War. The war between 1914 and 1918 was called the Great War until 1941. And then it was called the First World War. Of course, you couldn't call it the First World War in 1925, because you hoped there wouldn't be another one. And today you occasionally see again the name the Great War. It's coming back a bit. Cinema of the time. Another source which you might not expect is archaeological finds. When we imagine archaeology, we think of ancient Egypt or the Middle Ages. But in fact, the battlefields left huge amounts of objects which can be found. And here you have a few examples of archaeological finds. They found, for example, many objects which had been made by the soldiers. Been fabricated, many religious objects which they made out of whatever they had to hand. English people are always very surprised to know that in France you still discover First World War bombs every week around Amiens. Every week some farmer will say, hey, there's a bomb here. Normally they don't explode, but you can't, you don't touch them. You call the special service to come and get the bomb. And I think there's about, last year there were four tons of First World War bombs discovered in French fields. It's incredible, because during one of the big battles in 1917, there were a million bombs sent in 3 days. So I mean, you can imagine the numbers that are around there. So archaeological finds can be a source. And there is a book, Killing Time, Archaeology and the First World War. Here's a source you probably wouldn't think of. Nobody thought of this. And then one day, a historian said, oh, look at all those monuments. There are thousands and tens of thousands of monuments made in the 1920s. And one person decided to study them and study, you know, how many of the monuments are glorious? How many of the monuments are pacifistic? Yeah. What kind of text is used? Who decided what to put on the monuments? This is studying the grammar of monuments. One of the big questions is who decided? And when they studied who decided, they discovered that the ex-soldiers had very little influence. It wasn't decided by the soldiers. It was decided by the mayor and the local dignitaries. And there I've chosen a couple of examples. This one is the cenotaph in London, the main monument in London to the First World War. And what is fascinating about it is what there is not. Can anybody see what there is not on this monument? When you're studying history, you often have to look at what is not there, which is, can be a little difficult, yeah, what is not there. Well, just to give you a clue, it is there, and it's not there. No, it's not the name?
Cross.
Yeah, a religious symbol. Yeah, a cross, indeed, yeah. There is no religious symbol on the national monument erected in 1919. Now, today, in 2017, if you erect a national monument and there's no religious symbol, that's not surprising. But in 1919, that's very, very surprising indeed that there should be no religious symbol. And so there's a whole story about that. And if you look then at who decided, why did they decide, where was the monument placed in all the little villages, that makes you a historian in the true sense that he found a new question. And finding a new question, that's the hard bit. Answers are not so hard. Finding questions, that's the hard bit. And here you have an example. I think this is the one. This is a French one. And I do you recognize this one? Very, very exceptional French monument to the war. Maudite soit la guerre. Il y en a 2000 qui disent à la gloire de nos morts, et il y en a un qui dit maudite soit la guerre. In Gentilly, and people go there to see it because it was a local one. And this is a child then who's writing, Maudite soit la guerre, nos chers enfants. So it's an anti-war monument, which is very, very rare. In general, glory is more common. Well, listen, thank you very much for your attention. You stayed awake for the whole seminar. I'll see you next week. Make sure that you look at the blog, because there is something on there for you to watch, and I will have some questions for you at the beginning of next week. And I'll just put up the address again in case you've missed it. Address if you need it.